And now, dear brethren, we are looking forward to Brother Pete's discourse. The title of his discourse is Cries of the Reapers Yesterday and Today. Cries of the Reapers Yesterday and Today. Brother Peter.
Thank you, Brother Chris, and good morning, brethren. 2 Peter 3:7, but the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. We believe we are now in this 1,000-year day of judgment and that the systems have been on fire since our Lord's return in 1874, beginning with the shaking up of the religious systems in the early harvest period. The reapers have been crying. These workers have been defrauded by the rich people who are at the top and in control. 1 Thessalonians 5:3, for then they will say peace and safety. Then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. Brother Russell thought that the destruction of the present heavens and earth might be completed shortly after 1914. In retrospect, we see all the destructive events that he spoke of have been coming in gradual waves or in labor pains of travail, which each spasm of these pains have become more frequent and more severe, all leading to a fantastic and final climax. James 5, verses 1 to 6. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached to the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. Since our Lord's return in 1874, we hear the cries of the reapers of labor crying for fair wages and justice. Notice verse 3. It says that the timing of this punishment upon the rich will be in the last days. The punishment of the rich will be so severe that they are described in verse 1 as weeping and howling in misery. In reprint 4997, Brother Russell says, their realization of the loss of practically all upon which they set their affections is represented as wailing and howling in misery. Not that the poor are more righteous than the rich, but having little of this world's goods, they will probably feel less the great time of trouble impending. Let's look at a little bit at the history of money lending. From as early as the time of Abraham, we learn in the history, gold and silver were a prominent form of wealth. Genesis 13:2 says, Abram was rich in livestock, silver, and gold. The law of Moses allowed a lender to collect interest from a foreigner, but not from a brother, and especially not if he becomes poor. Exodus 22:25, if you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like the money lenders to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. Leviticus 25:37, nor give him your food for profit. Deuteronomy 23:20, you may charge a foreigner interest. In Nehemiah chapter 5, Nehemiah stopped the wealthier Jews from charging interest on the poor brothers who were at the point of being sold into slavery to pay their debts. The idea of banks began as long ago as 1800 BC in Babylon. In those days, moneylenders made loans to people. In Greece and Rome, banks made loans and accepted deposits. In Jesus' day, the temple money changers were robbing the people. Then Matthew 21:12-13, then Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. Reprint 4122. Brother Russell says, there was a certain temple tax levied which must be paid in a particular kind of money called the shekel of the sanctuary. The last coinage of these was BC 140. Hence, they were quite scarce in the Lord's day and sold at a premium. So in Jesus' day, the greedy religious rulers set up a system whereby they could gouge the people through a form of religious extortion, placing a financial burden upon the people, forcing them to buy the expensive temple coin for their own gain and profit. Brother Russell revealed the fraud in the world's banking systems. However, he was not condemning the good and honest people working in it, which are the large majority of them, but rather the wealthiest people at the top who misuse the world's banking systems to advance their own selfish schemes to the harm of the world's citizens. So throughout this talk, as we levy some criticisms at the banking systems, we're not criticizing the 99% of the people going to work, doing their jobs, honorable jobs, being honest, supporting families. We're talking about that 1% at the top who are secretly controlling and manipulating for their advantage. Here's a picture of President Woodrow Wilson signing the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, thereby creating America's third central bank and undoing the work of Presidents James Madison and Andrew Jackson, who had fought so hard to kill the first two central banks. Let's look at the fraud that James talks about that existed in Brother Russell's day. Reprint 5632. Brother Russell says, since the beginning of the war, there have been bonds and stocks sold as low as 30 cents less than those last July. But the exchanges did not recognize these sales. Why? They wished to keep the prices up. If the government inspectors should come in to take stock, they would say, you must make this right before you can enter into business tomorrow morning, end quote. In other words, these gold-backed bond sales were misreported to deceive the public so they would not realize that there was not near enough gold to back up these bonds. Volume 4, page 472. The bankers and moneylenders think, let us delude the poorer and less shrewd by calling gold honest money and silver dishonest money. Many of the poor desire to be honest and can thus be browbeaten and cajoled into supporting our plans, which, however, will go hard with the reapers. He's referring to the farmers. Under the influence of our talk about honest money and our prestige as honorable men, our standing as financiers and wealthy men, they will conclude that any views contrary to ours must be wrong, end quote. The bankers and money lenders deceived the public into believing that silver was not honest money in order to succeed in their scheme to demonetize silver. Does this idea of brainwashing the public by repeated lies and spinning the truth sound familiar today? Reprint 2042, quoting the late Senator Vance, "The power of money and its allies throughout the world have entered into this conspiracy to perpetuate the greatest crime of this or any other age, to overthrow one half of the world's money and thereby double their own wealth, by enhancing the value of the other half, which is in their hands." Reprint 2042, the International Agricultural Congress addressing candidate William Jennings Bryan, saying, "We wish you success in your struggle against the domination of the creditor class, which during the past 23 years has secured both in Europe and America monetary legislation destructive of the prosperity of your farmers and others. We believe that failing such restoration of silver money privileges, the gold premium throughout all Asia and South America will continue to rob the farmer, equally of America and Europe, of all rewards for his toil. Silver at once dropped to one half the price of gold, and all of this evils of its denomination were felt to the full in 1894. Volume 4, page 396. "Indeed, while the relationship between the two metals had for years been about 16 parts of silver to one gold in value, the tendency, rather, was for the silver to appreciate and the gold to depreciate relatively. Because silver was money, the world chiefly used and favored above gold by the people, except in Great Britain." So silver was chiefly used by the people. And notice, Brother Russell said that historically these two metals, but in essence what he was saying is, you could buy 1 ounce of gold with 16 ounces of silver, historically. But at his time it had changed. You could actually buy, silver was actually a little bit more valuable than gold. London being the center of the world's banking and having gold in abundance, these bankers had selfish motives, therefore, to increase the value of gold at the expense of the rest of the world. Volume 4, page 396. "It is not surprising, therefore, that, as shown by statistics, a silver dollar commanded a premium of over 2 cents above a gold dollar in 1872. Now, brethren, this manipulation of the currencies by the bankers is continued to this day. In Brother Russell's day, he's saying that at that point, silver was a little bit more valuable than gold. Now, today, it takes over 70 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. So this manipulation has not ended. Volume 4, page 389. "Regarding the price of wheat, philosophers, statesmen, and scientists have very generally have hastily come to the conclusion that every fall in the price of wheat is wholly the result of overproduction." So everyone was thinking that these horrible falling prices that were hurting the farmers were the result of overproduction. On the chart, we see that between 1883 and 1893, wheat production declined, so there was not overproduction. This data was pulled from the Cries of the Reapers chapter in Volume 4 and put into a table. The problem was not overproduction. Farmers worldwide were suffering the consequences of the demonetization of silver, which made the wealthy and the bankers who held the gold twice as rich, but as for the farmers and many others, their wealth was cut in half. So the conventional wisdom of overproduction was not the truth, and it misled the public. The next chart shows that in 1872, it was cheaper to buy wheat with silver. You could buy that bushel of wheat for only 98% of what it would cost you to buy it with gold. By 1894, it cost twice as much to purchase wheat with silver, meaning that the value of silver was cut in half. You could only buy that bushel with silver for 203% of what it cost to buy it in gold. We're going to show you a clip from episode 4 of The Hidden Secrets of Money. There are 7 episodes. It took a couple hundred thousand dollars or more to produce each episode, so their quality. We're only going to show you a clip, but we recommend that everyone watch the full episode 4 of The Hidden Secrets of Money so that this will be come more clear.
The founding fathers of the United States knew the dangers of central banking and fought to free themselves from this very thing. The Revolutionary War started out as a tax revolt, but now we must pay tax just to have a monetary system. Having just suffered through the hyperinflation of the continental dollar, which was printed into oblivion to finance the Revolutionary War, they understood the dangers of fiat currency and debt-based monetary systems. So to protect future generations from institutional theft and out-of-control government, they wrote into the Constitution that only gold and silver can be money for the simple fact that you can't print them. Our current system is not only unconstitutional, but it robs us of the liberty and prosperity our forefathers fought and died for. We are all feeling the effects of ignoring the Constitution right now. By forcing more currency into circulation, our purchasing power is diluted. Inflation is a slow and insidious stealth tax that is simply the result of this debt-based monetary system. This system empowers and benefits those who create the currency and receive it first, as they get to spend it into circulation before it has an effect on the economy. They're stealing purchasing power from you and transferring it to the banks and the government every hour of every day because of this false monetary system. And it's not like the people at the top don't know this. To quote the Federal Reserve, the decrease in purchasing power incurred by the holders of money due to inflation imparts gains to the issuers of money. This is a fraud. It is a pyramid scheme. It is a Ponzi scheme. It's a scam and it's a lie. Our entire monetary system is nothing but a form of legalized theft. But here's the biggest con job of them all. The Federal Reserve is not federal. It has stockholders. There is no federal agency that has stockholders. What's a stockholder? A share of stock represents a percentage of ownership in a corporation. So the stockholders are the owners of that corporation. Therefore, the Federal Reserve is a private corporation with owners. And you can see it for yourself if you go to the Federal Reserve's website, and it will say, the stockholders receive an annual dividend of 6%. Now, we know that the stock in the Federal Reserve was originally issued to the largest banks in the United States. But because of mergers and acquisitions through the years, you can't actually trace who owns the stock in the Federal Reserve. That's a very closely guarded secret. My guess would be that the owners are those primary dealers, the banks that get to make a profit by selling part of our national debt, those bonds, to the Federal Reserve, who buys them with a check from nothing. Then we pay tax to pay the principal and the interest on those bonds so that the Federal Reserve can pay the banks a 6% dividend. Don't be alarmed if you don't quite comprehend the deception of this system at first glance. Very few people do. It is purposely complex. The economist John Maynard Keynes once wrote, "By this means, government may secretly and unobserved confiscate the wealth of the people, and not one man in a million will detect the theft." I believe that presented correctly, anyone can understand this system, regardless of how complex it is. So let's do a recap and break it down even more. The way the system works is that, step one, the government creates glorified IOUs. These bonds increase our national debt and put the public on the hook to pay it back. Step two, IOUs are swapped to create currency. The Treasury sells the bonds to the banks. The banks then turn around and sell our national debt at a profit to the Federal Reserve, which they probably own. The Federal Reserve then opens its checkbook that doesn't have a penny in it and buys those IOUs with IOUs that it writes, checks, on a checking account that has a zero balance. Then they give those checks to the banks and currency just springs into existence. And then the whole process repeats. This results in a buildup of bonds at the Federal Reserve and currency at the Treasury, which is really just a supply of numbers. The Treasury then deposits the numbers in the various branches of the government, and we get to step three. The government spends the numbers on promises, public works, social programs, and war. Then the government employees, contractors, and soldiers deposit their pay into the banks. And we get to step four, where the banks multiply the numbers by magically inventing more IOUs through fractional reserve lending, where they steal a portion of everyone's deposit and lend it out. That currency gets redeposited, and then a portion is stolen again. And the process repeats over and over, magnifying the currency supply exponentially. Then we work for some of those numbers, which brings us to step five, where our numbers are taxed. We pay tax to the IRS, who then turns our numbers over to the Treasury, so the Treasury can pay the principal plus the interest on bonds that were purchased by the Federal Reserve with a check from nothing. Then we get to step six, the debt ceiling delusion. The system is designed to require ever-increasing levels of debt and will eventually collapse under its own weight because politicians always kick the can down the road. They don't want it to collapse on their watch. And finally, step seven, the secret owners take their cut. The world's largest banks own the Federal Reserve. Those banks make a profit selling our national debt to the Fed. They make a profit when the Fed pays them interest on the reserves held at the Fed. And the Fed pays them a 6% dividend on their ownership of the Fed. This system is fundamentally evil. It funnels wealth from the working population to the government and the banking sector. It is the cause of the artificial booms and busts of modern economies, and it causes great disparity of wealth between the rich and the working class. And it is only possible because we no longer use real money, we use currency. But worst of all, it is a form of enslavement. Bond is the root word of bondage. Whenever a government issues a bond, it is a promise to make us pay tax in the future. Nobody asked you if you wanted to pay tax today for the prosperity we all enjoyed in the last century. Nobody is asking our children if they want to work hard in the future to pay for the prosperity we're enjoying now. George Washington once wrote to James Madison, "No generation has the right to contract debts greater than can be paid off during the course of its own existence." By stealing prosperity from tomorrow so we can spend it today, we enslave ourselves and future generations.
Mike Maloney in this video said that inflation is a slow and insidious stealth tax that is simply the result of this debt-based monetary system. They are stealing purchasing power from you and transferring it to the banks and the government every hour of every day, end quote. Now, as you can see from the chart, our purchasing power decreased over 95% since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913 to the year 2008. Today, the purchasing power is decreased to 98%. The Federal Reserve and the central banking system are robbing the people. There is no need for citizens to pay the Federal Reserve a 6% fee in interest on our debt for writing a check from a bank account with a zero balance. This is fraud. The government could just as well create currency from nothing, but without charging its citizens fees and interest. James 5:4. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which are kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. Proverbs 22:7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. Bondage. So the world's citizens have become slaves to the various central banks in each country, which are robbing the people of their wealth through debt, overspending, and inflation. So here's a chart showing the exploding consumer debt and home mortgage debt over time. You can see it just keeps going up and up and up. Here's a chart showing the debt versus GDP. You notice the GDP at the bottom line? The debt is growing faster, far faster than the GDP. In 2008, it was 2.5 times larger. By the way, the Atlanta Fed's GDP model is projecting that the U.S. economic growth for the first quarter of 2017 will come in at just about 0.5%. If that pace continues for the rest of the year, it will be the worst year for the U.S. economic growth since the last recession. In this next episode 6, Mike Maloney interviews a demographic expert and author, Harry Dent.
Whatever bubble you're in, the opposite happens of what is of greatest benefit to the most people. Right now, if we went into big inflation or hyperinflation, the average Joe Sixpack would get rewarded for mass stupidity. They're all out on credit. We're in a credit boom. We're in a bond bubble. Those are the bubbles have to pop, and the popping of a credit bubble is deflationary.
It's deflationary. And history's crystal clear on that. A lot of the gold bugs say, the Federal Reserve and central banks, they're creating money, which they are unprecedented. But they're actually inflating to fight the deflation that started to set in the late 2008, early 2009. And if you look back at history, you say every major debt and financial asset bubble in history, the railroad bubble of the early 1870s that peaked, followed by deflation. You know, the auto and farm bubble and tractor bubble, that's actually a tractor bubble that caused the Great Depression. It was farms failing, and it was smaller local banks failing that caused the Great Depression and high unemployment. Deflation. Because the deflation has to root out the massive debt and the financial assets that get overinflated. And it's good if we bring down the cost of living, if we restructure debt, if we bring financial assets down, it actually improves our standard of living long term, but it is painful when it happens. Some people say the strategy didn't work. Well, no, it did work. We would have been in a depression, just like the early 30s. We were going to, banks were melting down, financial institutions, major Fortune 100 companies were failing like AIG. We would have imploded because once you have that much debt and leverage and things go wrong, it just builds the other way. Like you say, you get a bubble on one end, you get a crash. Bubbles don't correct. They burst. So we were going into that, but government said, no, we will do whatever it takes. Mario Draghi, Ben Bernanke. And they created trillions of dollars to fill the hole. Well, all that does, it's like taking more drugs to keep from coming down. I mean, a drug addict can keep taking more drugs until it kills them. Or until they just fall down and get dragged into detox. It's the exact same thing. Debt, especially when it's extreme, is a financial enhancing drug. It gives you more than you deserve, makes you feel better in the short term. But when it's over, you have to go through a detox, as they would call it, a debt detox. And that's where you get deflation. Each generation has been larger and more wealthy to help pay off the debts or the accumulation from an aging generation before them. What happens when the millennial is having to support a generation that's actually larger than them? And what happens when there's not enough for them to drive house prices back? I've got a model now for housing that says people spend the most on housing at age 41, but then when they die at age 79 or 80 on average, they become sellers. So I have to subtract the dyers from the buyers, and when I do that, baby boomers are going to be dying at higher rates than the millennials are going to be buying at some point. There's going to be net negative demand for housing. Everybody's thinking, oh, we're going to need more housing. No, not when a smaller generation follows a larger. So for entitlements, that's huge. There is no way this next generation in the U.S., nevertheless in Japan or Europe where they're much smaller, can even hope to pay the entitlements that have been promised to the baby boomers. It's a fairy tale. And housing will never be the same. We saw the Bob Hope generation come out of World War II, the first middle-class generation in history, where the average person could buy a house and a mortgage. That was not the case in the Roaring Twenties even. Only the affluent could do that. So that was a big boon for housing. Housing went up, the depression went away. Then the baby boom comes, unprecedented in numbers. All of our lifetimes, housing's gone up with a few exceptions here and there. Housing is going to do well to go sideways for the coming decades, nevertheless go up much again because of this generational shift. We've never seen this in history.
Using different terminology, Brother Russell described these bubbles popping. In volume 6, pages 579 and 80, he says, "We expect that when the financial storm shall sweep over Christendom, business and banks and insurance and property values will all go down together, that this indeed will constitute a serious feature of the trouble, carry dismay and chagrin in the hearts which have nothing else to rest upon, no heavenly treasures." These are some charts from Harry Dent's book, Sale of a Lifetime. There you see 109 million baby boomers. Now the baby boomers are starting to retire, and there's not enough people around to pay their Social Security, their benefits, or buy their homes when they die. Here's the exploding labor force. The graph has the labor force declining, because as the baby boomers retire, there's less people in the labor force. Here's the exploding home ownership. It topped off at 2005, but it's been declining ever since. A lot of the homes being bought now are being bought by flippers and investors. Here's a Dow megaphone pattern. A is the 1999... That's the 1999 crash. C is the 2008 crash. And he's projecting, this is just his opinion, that there will be a crash in 2017 or 2018 and the Dow will drop to 6,000 or less. That's Harry Dent's projection. This is James Rickard. He's in episode 7 and... we don't have time to read his background.
It seems like all of these bright minds that want to run things, none of them trust the free market mechanism.
Well, I think that's right. They will talk to you ad nauseum about the failures of the free markets without realizing that most of the so-called failures are actually the result of misguided government policies from prior times. I'll give you a classic example. In 1998... was a warning. That's, you know, started in 1997, capital outflows from emerging markets, started in Thailand, there was blood in the streets in Jakarta and Seoul, made its way to Russia, Russia imploded, took down the hedge fund, long-term capital management. I was associated with that, so I had a front row seat on that disaster. And finally, the world built a firewall around Brazil, and Brazil did not collapse, although it would have been the next domino to fall. Now, there was a clear-cut lesson. Capital markets came within hours of complete closure. And I was there, I sat with Peter Fisher, who was head of open market operations at the Fed, his associate, Dino Kos. We were on the phone with Bill McDonough, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Gary Gensler was there from the Treasury, all the lawyers, all the bankers on Wall Street. We were trying to hold this together. Now, we did bring it in for a soft landing, so the world has kind of forgotten about that episode. But it was extremely close and extremely delicate. We were literally hours away from shutting down global bond markets and stock markets. Now, what lessons were learned? Well, the lessons...
Well, that cascades into the credit card not working and the gas coming out, not coming out.
Correct.
Of the pump.
That's right. There would have been a global bank holiday, and we were hours away from that. Now, it didn't happen, so everyone's like, oh, no big deal, it's fine, you know. But there were some lessons that should have been learned. You know, banks should have been broken into smaller units. Derivatives should have been banned, you know, et cetera. There were things that should have been learned from that. Instead, what did we do? We did the opposite. We repealed Glass-Steagall, which allowed banks to be hedge funds. We repealed swaps regulation, which allowed them to create swaps and derivatives on all kinds of other things that had never been done before. We repealed the net capital rule for broker-dealers. So instead of 15-to-1 leverage, you were allowed to have 30-to-1 leverage, which Lehman had on the day it went down. We implemented Basel II, which allowed banks to use more leverage. We did the exact opposite of what we should have learned in 1998. Is it any surprise that 10 years later, we had a bigger catastrophe, almost destroyed capital markets again, and now here we are not learning the lessons again? We haven't done anything we need to do. So therefore, we're going to have another catastrophe sooner than later. It'll be bigger than 2008, but the next one's going to be strike three. We've had two warnings. They've been ignored. The third time, it's game over.
This chart shows the dot-com bubble, which burst in 1999, and then the 2008 credit bubble, which burst. But both times, the Federal Reserve and the banking system came in and put in money and prevented the natural course of events for the bad banks to go bankrupt and for the system to improve itself. So these bubbles just keep growing, and here we are today at 2017. In this time, you know, in 1999, we had a stock market bubble. 2008, we had two bubbles, which was the housing mortgage-backed securities that included real estate and stock. And today we have three bubbles: stocks, bonds, real estate. So bonds now are in the bubble. Reprint 3117. The treating of the stock shares as money is bringing fabulous wealth to numerous class, but many of these stocks are overvalued, overcapitalized. How much more true that is today. That's way more true than it was in Brother Russell's day. Today, the stock and bond market are inflated over any amount that Brother Russell could have dreamed of. The world is possibly poised for the greatest worldwide economic crash in history. However, the underlying issues are too complicated for someone like me to figure out or know for sure, but the possibilities sure look scary. Does anyone know what a derivative is? A derivative is a secondary or derived wager on the future price of an investment. It is a speculative bet. So we have $72 trillion in GDP for the world and $710 trillion in derivatives.
The entire economy of the world in real goods and services is evaluated at around $78 trillion annually. The derivative market is seven times the value of every good and every service provided around the world in an entire year. At first, I thought this number was too big to be real. But the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, Independent Bureau of the U.S. Department of the Treasury, confirms it. Make no mistake, you are looking at the biggest bubble in the history of mankind. something 7 times greater than the entire economy of the world. So what exactly is a derivative? A derivative is a speculative contract, a bet placed on stocks, mortgages, interest rates, the price of commodities like gold, silver, coffee, oil, or the possibility of a company or even a nation to default. Basically, right now, there is nothing of economic worth that does not have some sort of derivative attached to it. All derivatives are bets. This is not a metaphor, an analogy, or a generalization. The players on the derivative market gamble trillions on the future price of the asset to which the derivative is attached. These are the speculative contracts that will eventually pop the current gigantic bubble. Warren Buffett once referred to derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. And he was proven right. The CDOs that led to the crash of 2008 were derivatives, as they drew their value from interest payments on mortgages and housing prices. They were traded on this market just like all the other derivatives, and they were just a tiny part of the market. In 2008, there were about $500 billion worth of CDOs. That was only a very tiny fraction of the derivatives market, yet it was enough to almost collapse the economy of the world. Remember how I said that this is the world's largest casino? In a nutshell, the derivatives market, or more correctly put, the derivatives casino, is where big banks and other financial institutions place their bets on every aspect of the world economy. Yet with these bets, everybody loses. So how did this bubble inflate to more than $550 trillion? Sajak controls the derivative department of one of the too-big-to-fail banks. He knows that the riskier the bet, the higher the profit he gets, and the bigger his bonus. And he thinks, just like everyone else, that if he loses, the Federal Reserve will bail him out just like in 2008. What do you think Jack would do? How much do you think Jack would bet on derivatives? Well, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency has the exact numbers. Citigroup, total assets more than $1.8 trillion. Total exposure to derivatives, more than $53 trillion. J.P. Morgan Chase, total assets, about $2.4 trillion. Total exposure to derivatives, more than $51 trillion.
Okay, we're going to skip for time's sake. He lists several more banks, and it's all the same story. These huge number of derivatives, it's a fiction. It's pretend money, and the underlying assets are only a tiny percent. Is the economy really in bad shape? On November 15th, 2014, a G20 summit of world leaders welcomed the proposal of the Financial Stability Board, or FSB. The report says that bank losses should be absorbed by unsecured and uninsured creditors. In this context, a creditor means a depositor, you and me. The report then described bail-in power and to write down and convert into equity all the parts of the firm's unsecured liabilities to the extent necessary to absorb the losses. So what the G20 in essence decided is that they had bail-in power. Just like Greece, they could freeze our accounts and take our money. Instead of a bailout where the government uses taxpayer money to save the banks, if a bank's in trouble, derivatives take priority. And the depositor, that's not our money. We're a lender to the bank. We're an unsecured lender. And so the bank has to be made whole, and then they can give us, in place of our money, stock equity. So we'd have equity in a bankrupt bank. On Wednesday, July 23rd, 2014, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, approved a new rule by a 3-2 vote that allows money market funds to suspend investor redemptions. The SEC rule pushes this thievery beyond banking into the world of investments. Now money market funds could be refused to be returned to investors. James Rickard says that in this next financial panic, not only will your bank account be bailed in, your money market account will be frozen. So let's look at the financial condition of the economy. And we really don't have time for this, so we're going to go through this really fast. What does the economy look like today? Store closings are at an epic pace. So far, more than 8,600 brick-and-mortar stores will close their doors in 2017. Retailers are going bankrupt at a record pace. 14 chains will seek bankruptcy protection, almost surpassing all of 2016. Look at this chart. All the way, already on April 16th, the number of retail bankruptcies is almost caught up to those in 2016. Factory output tumbles. This began in 2014. This never happens without the U.S. economy being in a recession. Restaurants in the worst tailspin since 2009-2010. Foot traffic's down in the first quarter. In the last quarter of 2016, during the holidays, when it's supposed to be up, it was down. U.S. auto inventory. Nearly all the big automakers are reporting disappointing results. Their dealer inventories are increasing. U.S. subprime auto loan losses are reaching incredible levels. Pension crisis, too big for markets to ignore. Housing bubbles popping up all over the world. 6 in 10 Americans don't have $500 in savings. Bureau of Labor Statistics, not a single person is employed in nearly 1 out of every 5 U.S. families. Student debt, $1.3 trillion per student, that's over 37,000. The first quarter of 2017, budget deficit, $527 billion deficit for the U.S. economy. American consumers are holding $1 trillion in revolving credit. 45% of Americans that have debt spend up to half their monthly income in debt repayment. Will the government and banks help us? No. The G20 got together and said that we depositors are unsecured creditors and we should absorb losses. The SEC ruling said the same about money markets. And here's some articles that confirm about these bail-ins and how the banks can take our money. So we don't have time for that. We're just about out of time, and we're about halfway through the talk. Brother Russell talked about banks suspending payment to depositors. He also talked about gold will probably go to a premium, and there's reasons for that. Should we prepare for the economic collapse? Well, the Bible says, seek ye first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Now, we don't really know if and when there's going to be an economic collapse. There's just a lot of scary signs, and the mainstream news media tells us everything's great. The stock market's booming, but we think that's artificial. It's being manipulated. Joseph put away, stored up for the years of famine. So should we? Well, if we have a couple of months' supply of food at home, you know, canned food and other foods that we can rotate, spending a little bit of money up front, but not any more overall. What might survive an economic collapse? Well, assets like cars and equipment, they might depreciate, but we'd own them. supplies, food, and water. Any valuable skills we have, like vegetable gardening, where we could grow our own food, building and construction, repair, those skills would come in handy. Holding physical precious metals, not stock, because precious metal stocks would be lost in a collapse, like gold and silver, and those could be held in the depository in the 401k retirement plan, and your 401k could be rolled over to that. Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are independent of the banking systems, although some of these may not be safe, but it may be a temporary measure if there were a collapse. Real estate owned, even if it depreciates greatly in value, if you own it, it's still yours. How about AAA bonds, banks, money market accounts? Well, these were safe in the 2008 crash, but according to some of the news, it's possible that they may not be again. Will gold and silver be worthless, where it says they'll cast their gold and silver into the streets? Well, it'll be worth a lot in the kingdom because they'll be bringing gifts of gold and silver to Israel. But Brother Russell brings out this example of in connection with casting the gold and the silver into the street of this Miller Bartello. The people came after him. He threw coins and bargained to give them all his wealth if they'd spare his life, and they wouldn't. They'd kill him. And so the point here is people are going to be so angry and so hateful to what these wealthy have done that they will no longer be able to be bribed, not even by the most valuable things like gold and silver. Now, in Brother Russell's day, they were bankers were manipulating the price of gold and silver. They're still doing it today. The reasons are to so that they can purchase these metals themselves cheap and store up on them, so they could attract the middle class to rising paper assets like stocks and bonds, and then rob the middle class of their wealth when they bring on these sudden crashes. And this fraud's being discovered now. Deutsche Bank has to pay $60 million to settle for gold manipulation. Record $10 trillion in gold manipulation. More has been discovered. And there you have this chart in 2016. They're trading $9,600 billion in paper gold, but they only have $42 billion in inventory. So it's fraud. It's supply and demand. They're trading more gold than they have to keep the price of gold down, because if people start investing in gold and silver, it will devalue the fiat currencies, the counterfeit money they're producing. J.P. Morgan, silver manipulation, they're back in the courts about that. The silver manipulation's really terrible. Here's what they have in inventory, 190 million ounces, and yet they're trading over 1 billion ounces when they only have less than 200 million in inventory. So I guess we're out of time. So we hope this has been of interest, and maybe it will generate some further discussion. And we'll leave it with that.